So this reading is called When We Lost, and I always struggle, even though I'm a social justice minister, with being too partisan. So I want you to see, even though I'm sitting here looking at pussy hats everywhere, I want you to generalize this. Bring it in, listen to it, because it's coming, this particular reading is coming directly from the left side of the spectrum. In the past couple of years, two great waves of despair have come in, or perhaps waves is too energetic a term, since the despair felt like a stall, a becoming, a running aground. The more recent despair was over the presidential election in the United States, as though the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano commented, George W. Bush was running for president of the world. And he won. Despite the opposition of most of the people in the world, despite the polls, despite the fact that the majority of U.S. voters did not choose him or John Kerry, 40% of the electorate stayed home, despite a surge of organization and activism by progressives and leftists who didn't even agree with Kerry on so very much, despite the terrible record of violence and destruction that Bush had accrued, despite the stark disaster the Iraq War had become, he won. Which is to say, we lost. The pain was very real, and it was generous-hearted. Felt by many people who would not suffer directly, but would see that that which they loved assaulted further. That empathy was generous, and so was the sense of exhaustion. We had imagined taking off the terrible burden that is Bush, and it was painful to resume that leaden weight for four more years. We felt clearly the pain of the circumstances to which we had grown numb. But the despair was something else again. Sometime before the election was over, I vowed to keep away from what I thought of as the conversation. The tailspin of mutual wailing about how bad everything was. A recitation of the evidence against us that just buried any hope and imagination down into a dank little foxhole of curled up despair. Now, after losing to Bush, I watched people having it, the conversation. Wondering, what is it we get from the conversation? Is it the certainty of despair? Is even that kind of certainty so worth pursuing? You know, stories trap us. Stories free us. We live and die by stories. But hearing people have the conversation is hearing them tell themselves a story they believe is being told to them. What other stories can be told? How can people recognize that they have the power to be storytellers, not just listeners? Hope is the story of uncertainty, of coming to terms with the risk involved in not knowing what comes next, which is more demanding than despair, and in a way, more frightening, and immeasurably more rewarding. What strikes you when you come out of a deep depression or get close to a depressed person is the utter self-absorption of misery, which is why the political imagination is better fueled by looking deeper and farther. Well, I have this cousin named Joe. He is a funny guy, he is smart, and he does a lot of good in his life. He's a physical therapist. And I don't see him that often, but 2 Thanksgivings ago, he was at my brother's house. And when I see him, I always, he's unconscious. I think it's a little more conscious than that, actually, though. I'll kind of reach up and go like this. Kind of like, I just like had this twinge and I just can't figure out how to get rid of it. And like, clockwork, he'll come over and go, "Hey cousin, is your shoulder bothering you?" Yeah, too much time on the computer. And he will sit down, he'll sit me down in a straight back chair and give me a shoulder massage. And it always feels so good. Some people, especially if it's their life work, are really good at massage. And those therapeutic hands go right to that spot. Because, yeah, I do spend too much time at my computer. And I know he does this all day, but he doesn't seem to mind. So when I say Joe is a good guy, I mean, he is a really good guy. But just don't get him talking about the state of the world or of the nation. He just lets loose with the darkest, most distressing talk. Now, we're both on the progressive side. Did any of you guys figure that out about me? Except it doesn't feel like we're on the same side. Everyone in power is evil, and everything is stacked against normal people. We have no power. Corporations stalk the earth, and there's nothing that we can do about them. He thinks that George W. ordered 9/11 to happen. He doesn't vote because there is no point. He is this charming gentleman, and suddenly he is someone else. And when I listen to him, I feel like I have fallen into a dry well. All I can see are the bricks in a tight circle around me. Well, this time, he noticed my smile was kind of weakening, and I wasn't making eye contact anymore. And yeah, he said, "My kids don't like when I talk this way." I thought, "Yeah, I bet." And he says, "They call it my dad rant." And then he asked me, "Well, what do you think?" And he's asking me about the state of the world. But I'm so distressed by the way he's been talking that I just answer, "You know, I can't believe that there is no hope. I just can't live that way." And then it was time for dinner, but I couldn't forget it. I mean, honestly, that conversation followed me around like a little cloud for a couple of weeks. "Joe, how can you live this way?" Because I can't give up on hope. I just can't give up on hope. Now, I first started this sermon before the recent election, which has thrown this idea of hope into a new relief. Yeah? Before the election, I was worried we wouldn't move fast enough on climate change. Now I'm afraid we won't move at all, and in fact, we will go backward. And in fact, that sentence was written a few weeks ago, actually, and now I should revise it and say, we are moving backwards. Scott Pruitt, climate change denier, is the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. President Trump says that he wants to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. They're still kind of not there yet. Without United States leadership, it's hard to imagine we will get anywhere on climate change. Things don't look good right now. Positive change feels hopeless. I feel helpless and angry. Suddenly,
suddenly, I am feeling a lot like my cousin Joe. So, I need this sermon as much as you do. And when I deliver the sermon, I always go, yeah, I gotta remember that. There is hope, even when things are going badly for our side. One source of hope is knowing that you have power. No matter who you are, you have power. Or heck, you can make power. Now, in Liberia, in West Africa, the least powerful people are the women and children. In the not so distant past, probably about 5 years ago, I think is when it ended, Liberia had two terrible civil wars that ravaged the country. All kinds of awful things happened. I think Liberia is where the term child soldier came from. Those rebels would capture children and turn them into soldiers. It's estimated that 60% of the women in the country were raped. Half the people were driven from their homes and were living in refugee camps. Lima Gbawi, a Liberian woman, didn't know anything about power. If you'd asked her, she would have said that she didn't have any. But, and I love this story because it's like the Bible in present time. One night, she had a dream. And a dream where she felt a cold wind sweep over her. And a voice said, "Gather the women and pray for peace." She went to her pastor because she thought maybe he could gather the women and pray for peace. But he just smiled at her and shook his head. He's kind of one of my favorite people in the story. He says, "The dream bearer is always the dream carrier." Nina didn't want to hear that. She told him, "You know, I am no saint. I have 3 children, and I've never had a husband. I have a boyfriend now, even. Pastor, do you know that I like to drink? I'm really not the best person to do this." And her pastor just smiled at her and shook his head. This guy was really good at delegating. "Lima, if you don't bear this dream, the next time you see it, you won't recognize it." He wouldn't take it from her. So she gathered the women to pray. First, it was just the women from her church. Then, all Christian women were welcome. All the Christian women of Liberia. And then she invited the Muslim women of Liberia to join them. And oh, it wasn't easy. It could have failed so many times. There were moments when they would have problems both internal and external. Sometimes the women would start fighting across these sectarian lines. And she would have to calm them. And sometimes it would come from the outside. And then, usually right when things were at their darkest, someone, a respected imam or the Catholic bishop, would support them. And then things would calm down for a while. This movement of women grew. And they prayed. Muslim and Christian together. At strategic moments, these praying women would show up and hold their violent, disreputable leaders accountable. They used to lie on their back in the sun praying. It would stop traffic, you know, Equatorial Africa noon. It would stop traffic. It looked so odd. Lena said they did it because old women told them of this practice. So, you know, I'm extrapolating here, but I think this was probably something that came from before Christianity, from before Muslim time. Charles Taylor, the war criminal leader, one time drove past them and they're all lying out in a field praying, staring at the sun. And he asked his aide, "Are they cursing me?" When the war was almost over and peace negotiations were going on, these powerless women filled the lobby of the building where negotiations were going on. And they prayed. Lena, by then, was the accepted, acknowledged leader of the women. And she passed a message to the chief mediator, General Abu Bakr, that the women would interlock their arms and remain seated in the hallway, holding the delegates hostage until a peace agreement was reached. Abu Bakr announced, "The peace hall has been seized by General Lima and her troops." The thing is, seizing negotiations with Charles Taylor. So Charles Taylor and his men tried to leave the hall because the negotiations at one point were breaking down. And Lima was like beside herself. So, I mean, she just started making it up, flanked by respectable elder women who were a part of this peace movement. They threatened to rip their clothes off right there and then. And in Africa, it's a terrible curse to see a married or elderly woman deliberately burying themselves. The men were stopped in their tracks and turned around and walked back into the room and kept negotiating. These women were a constant moral presence and were credited with keeping the negotiations going. In 2011, Lena Nagawi won the Nobel Peace Prize. Her words on creating power: "Don't wait for a Gandhi. Don't wait for a king. Don't wait for a Mandela. You are your own Mandela. You are your own Gandhi. You are your own king." Now I wonder, as I tell that story, what my cousin Joe, master of the conversation, would think. By his formula of the world, Lima and the praying women of Liberia shouldn't exist because all the power was held by the overlords. And yet, they do exist and they do have real power. Now, the United States, too, has a tradition of women working for peace. Dr. Spock, who's a guy, I'll admit that, the baby doctor who taught all of our parents to breastfeed their babies when they cried instead of putting the babies on feeding schedules. You remember that guy? He was also a famous peace activist and got his start because of women working for peace. One day he walked past the Kennedy White House and saw some women protesting the testing of nuclear weapons. And he thought, he looked at these women. There were just a few women. It was raining. They had homemade signs. Their signs were kind of melting. He found himself wondering about them. If these women were out there, maybe he should be too. One of the ways that we keep hope alive is by remembering that you really don't know what's going to happen in the future. And I think there's a corollary to that. You really don't know who you're influencing. Within that uncertainty is a real hope for the possibility of change. Hope is an emotion of the imagination. Now, despair is the opposite of hope, because despair is certain about the future. This is the territory of my cousin Joe. He knows what is going to happen in the future, and that it is going to be bad. Sometimes we feel like we have a pretty good idea of what will happen. President Trump is appointing people who have a certain track record. We know what they want to do. However, there are all kinds of things that will be happening at the same time that will either reinforce or undermine what he is doing, what any of those appointees are doing. It's part of our humanness that we think we know what the future will bring, even though we don't. We think it will be more of the same. We have a hard time imagining anything different. But we didn't know that the wall was coming down in Berlin in the 1980s. We didn't know in the 90s, when same-sex marriage was being defeated over and over again, that it would flip, and in 2015, same-sex marriage would become legal in every state. Hope isn't a certainty that the future will be better. It's that there are possibilities for the future. The one certain thing is that we can't be certain. In that uncertainty, that's where hope resides. Now, the women in front of the White House in 1961 were part of a group called Women Strike for Peace. They formed against nuclear war and were against above-ground nuclear testing, which was happening in the deserts of the Southwest and on small islands in the Pacific Ocean, in Russia and in Siberia. Strontium-90 was beginning to show up in mother's breast milk. It was still common then for anyone protesting to be called a communist. And being called a communist in the late 1950s and in the early 1960s was serious. The women in Women Strike for Peace were mostly white, and they played up their middle-class respectability. They wore flowery hats, not pussy hats, flowery hats, and white gloves. They were not wearing miniskirts. I think this was actually just a little bit before miniskirts. This was Leave It to Beaver's mother out protesting. No one called them communists, and if they got arrested, it looked terrible on television. On that day that Dr. Spock got inspired, a woman, Carrie Newland, was out there in front of the White House carrying a sign. It was raining hard, and it was quite cold. She was trying to carry an umbrella and a sign, and the sign kept bending as it got wetter and wetter. She was chilled and physically uncomfortable, and worse, feeling utterly futile. It was just a small band of women, you see. I don't think women in the 50s felt especially powerful, do you? She didn't know that she was inspiring a great peace activist to sign on to their cause. She might have liked that idea. She didn't know then that Women Strike for Peace would have a large peace march in about a year on November 1, 1961, that would rise up in 60 U.S. cities and involve 60,000 people. She wouldn't know that President Kennedy would watch from his window, peering through the curtains as they marched and protested in front of the White House. She didn't know that her group would be credited with stopping above-ground testing with the 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty, that women's strike for peace would weaken the House Committee on Un-American Activities because they were so obviously not communists. She didn't know any of that. She just knew she couldn't leave because she couldn't let her friends down. She couldn't let her children down, who she was afraid would have no future. Perhaps in that wet and dispiriting moment, she really didn't have hope. But she had dogged determination. She also had friends. And as she left the protest, that rainy, hopeless protest, she would disappoint her friends and betray herself and her children. And so she stayed. If you are lucky, hope can appear like grace, like a little singing bird. Hope comes welling up from our deepest self. I wish on you a hope that comes, as for Terry Newland, from your deepest bedrock faith. Because sometimes faith and hope are the same thing. Your faith is in a future that you simply cannot give up hope in. It's shining out there with strands of possibilities that we cannot predict. We can only live our life with the conviction that we cannot know what the future will bring, but that we do have the power to change it. We can change it if we would be our own Mandela, our own Gandhi, our own king. Amen. So may it be. And now we have time for questions and comments that you might want to address to our speaker.
And I saw the hat thing on your Facebook page. I was like, oh, who's the speaker? What's going on? And the first picture that came up was you wearing your hat. I was like, oh, we should do something with a penny hat. I saw them for the first time. A very good friend of mine from Minnesota was talking about them, and I just didn't get it. I didn't get it. I really didn't get it. And the names, you know, and I was like, oh, this is something to make fun of. And it's really not. And I just really turned 180 degrees and the song, you know, helped me there, and the movement is really kind of touched me, and now I'm the person that other people are kind of making fun of, and I remember being that person, and somebody recently told me that I shouldn't get on the bandwagon. I'm like, what? The band is its own wagon? This sounds awesome. So I think that there is hope, and there are steps that we can take, and sometimes they seem small, but I think that when it's time to hope, it's not a small step.
Thank you. This week and I can walk one around too.
Thank you for your message. I think it combines really nicely to last week's message by Reverend Tracy, in that, well, first, I'm a lot like your cousin, and I tend to despair. It's easier to despair looking around, and it's harder to find hope, and the combination between last week was not to be an isolationist, because I tended to think, okay, I've got a family, and I've got to take care of them, no matter what else happens, that's, you know, they're relying on me, and the rest of the world might go to crap, but I got to take care of me and my own, and it's hard to become more generous and expand the boundaries and think, well, I've got a community I can help take care of, too, so that's something I was inspired from last week, and then this week felt it was a very good combination of, you've got to look for hope. It is harder. It's easier to fall into despair, but you don't know who you might inspire, who might be listening, and even little steps within itself can make a big difference personally and within your community. So thank you.
It is a faith, you know, not holding hope. And also, sometimes you can substitute other things that might be more natural to you. You know, if you find that fellowship makes a big difference, you can kind of ride along in somebody else's hope. I mean, fellowship feels like hope, actually, doesn't it? Because it makes you feel hopeful because you have this community to be together with.
Thank you for speaking today. And I was reading an article in the most recent UU World last night. When one phrase kind of stuck out for me. She was saying that despair is a privileged response, and that maybe some people don't have time for despair or don't have room in their lives for despair. And I was kind of wondering what you might think of that.
Well, maybe a certain kind of despair, but I think despair seems like kind of I get the point you're making, and it's like what you're saying is that we get to kind of choose. If we're privileged, we can kind of choose our attitude. It's more easy. It's easier for us to choose our attitude, and that's an easy one to have because it doesn't require anything of you. And if you're privileged, then you can just go along in your life. But I think the feeling of despair, that sure feels like a universal thing, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Thanks, Katie.
Yeah.
Over the past 6 or 7 weeks, a lot of my friends have been in despair, and I think I'm going out of the time about how to help them. And what I found is where my mind usually goes is I present the other side as something. So someone will say, well, Trump's doing this, and this is bad. And I'll say, I'll just pick something. But I'll pick the other side of something.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say, well, you know, Obama did this, or, you know, Trump's also doing this, or, you know, there's also this. So this one colleague in my office, she was really sobbing during this time when Trump was elected. And I said something to her that was presenting the other side, and she looked at me and she said, Dan, I had no idea that you really didn't get it. I thought you, like me, understood that liberal was right and that we've lost the right. And in these last 7 weeks, what I've noticed with her is that she's gotten calmer and calmer because there are several of us in the office, I don't know if this is why, of course, but who are presenting this other side. And all we're doing is just saying, you know, there are multiple realities. There isn't just one reality. And I've been reminded of this thousands of times. You know, when I get anxious or when I get this or that, I'm convinced there's only one reality. We forget that life is all things when we're upset. And so I was just reminding her, really, by saying different things, a lot of which upset her, that there are many, you have not lost your life. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And I just want to say one thing about your story, because I think what happened with the election, and it was partly because it was a surprise for a lot of liberals. I mean, I was surprised. And so because of that, it was like a trauma. You know, I mean, it wasn't like a slow-moving thing that you could get ready for. It kind of went boom. And I mean, I don't mean to disrespect the word trauma in terms of some people have traumas that are so serious that they're life-threatening. This was a trauma we all experienced, though. There's degrees in trauma, and so a lot of people, especially in those first weeks, they were crying because they were grieving, and so sometimes the rules of engagement that go with grieving or perhaps more what you would want to use in those kinds of situations. And I think that sometimes people just aren't ready for that. You know, they're just not ready to hear another story. They need to have that moment of just because it was very raw. And have you noticed how people have changed over time? I've been watching, and as a minister, a social justice minister, kind of the first shock. I mean, it's kind of going in waves, and people are moving through it, not all at the same rate, because that won't ever happen, but people are moving through it, and, you know, I feel like we're different than we were when it first happened in terms of the way we feel about it. And I can't tell you exactly what that is. What it is, it's happening right now. I sort of feel like there's more determination now out in the world than there was when it first happened, when there was this kind of like, you know. Anything more?
Yeah, I have a couple more things to say. I look for guidance when my attitude gets bleak with the wonderful man, the elegant, strong, articulate man who was our president before, our first black president,
mm-hmm.
who was often called from the very beginning, no drama Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And as his office, at his time in office drew to an end, he would say, it's not the end of the world until it's really the end of the world. There's a silver lining that came with all of this, and it is our energizing to fight for what we believe in, and we have to remain persistent. I heard an interviewer say to Obama, how can you deal with the possibility that so much you worked for might be lost, particularly Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act? And he said, you know, at the very least, it will stand as a high bar in history that we'll be able to look back to as a standard. I mean, that guy can really make me feel better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting to hear more from him every day.
Having been a Unitarian Universalist in Memphis, Tennessee for way too many, 25, 26 years, since moving here, if people in Portland, Oregon lose hope that things can be better, then in Memphis, Tennessee, they are doomed. So I keep having to remind myself that what we can do here, you have no idea what it means to people in Memphis, Tennessee. When we go to a national, I went to the March for Women's Lives in, I think, 1989. I was pregnant with somebody. And so I think it was 1989. And I know the power that came from that. So I just want everybody to know that if y'all give us hope, we're just in trouble. And what you say to other people, to be a Unitarian Universalist, to be a liberal in the Deep South, you have to be way committed. You can't do it halfway. And we need the masses to say, we're not the crazy people on the fringe, but that's how normal people are. So please don't give up hope in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you. And I got to make a little tiny pitch. I'm going to be talking about my organization, Oregon Unitarian Universalist Voices for Justice, at 12, and down in the Forest Room. And so if you want to hear more about social justice here in Oregon, I know that this congregation is very active, and so hearing about another aspect of social justice in Oregon, you might find it interesting.
Thank you very much.